Last week, I was guiding a group of people to the Normandy battlefields. There were 34 people on this tour, and in amongst them were three teenagers, ranging from 13 to 17. I wondered, when I saw them when I boarded the coach, how much interest they would have in what we were going to be discussing over the next few days. I speculated as to whether they'd been press ganged by their parents since coming on this tour, it being the Whitsun half-term holiday. But I was wrong. They were fascinated by the stories that they uncovered along the way. They listened, they engaged, they helped me with some of the tasks, and they asked lots and lots of questions. And one of them, a young man called Charlie, volunteered and read beautifully the Ode to Remembrance as we closed our tour in one of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries. It was a special moment, a moment that I will never forget, and I doubt he will either. And then when I got home, I found waiting for me the Spring Chronicle of the Commonwealth War Graves Foundation, the charitable arm of the commission. And within it, there was a story about one of those men that died on the first day of the Somme, 1st of July 1916. He was a Sergeant John William Streets, serving with the Sheffield City Battalion, the Sheffield Pals. Although he excelled in academics, he forfeited his place at grammar school to support his family of 11 siblings by working down the mines. He did that between the ages of 14 and 28, still educated himself in his spare time, and then he joined the Sheffield Pals in August of 1914. And a few days before he died, on that fateful day, he wrote a poem called A Soldier's Cemetery. I wanted to include this poem in this week's podcast. I was going to read it myself, and then I thought, no, it would be better if we heard it from Zoe, one of the teenagers that had engaged so well on the tour last week and had gone home to tell all her friends about the tour that she'd been on. So this is Zoe's voice reading a poem written by Sergeant John William Streets a few weeks before he died in the run-up to the Battle of the Somme, A Soldier's Cemetery.
Behind the long and lonely trench line, to which men come and go where brave men die, there is yet unmarked and unknown shrine, a broken plot, a soldier's cemetery. There lie the flower of youth, the men who scorned to live, so died, when languished liberty across their graves, flowerless and unadorned, still scream the shells of each artillery. When war shall cease, this lonely unknown spot of many a pilgrimage will end, and flowers will shine in this now barren plot, and fame upon it through the years will descend. But many a heart upon each simple cross will hang the grief, the memory of its loss.
A big thank you there to Zoe for reading that. And as for Sergeant John William Streets, he's buried not far from where he died in the Euston Road Cemetery at Collincamps. And his headstone reads this. These words no doubt chosen by his family. It says, I fell, but yielded not my English soul that lives out here beneath the battle's roll. Just one more story, really, from the Somme, and my way of engaging the young people who, believe me, despite what people think, if they're engaged properly, I was fascinated by this subject of the two world wars as we are. But this week's podcast isn't about the Somme or Ypres. In fact, it's about Normandy and the Second World War. And we start off by listening to a reference given to a soldier, who I suppose is the main feature of this week's episode. Was a young, fresh, dashing man of position, quick in resolution, better in attack than in defence, ambitious, conscious of his abilities, but always eager to learn. and I know without hate against the Canadians, murder of prisoners is not in his line. Those words were being spoken at the trial of Kurt Mayer, the commanding officer of a Waffen SS unit, and he was standing trial in December of 1945 for the murder of Canadian prisoners of war. In June of 1944, just after the Canadians had landed on Juno Beach. That personal reference was being provided to the court by his commanding officer. But Mayer, despite this evidence, was found guilty and he was sentenced to death. He was going to be shot. But then a Major General Chris Vokes commuted Mayer's sentence to life imprisonment, suggesting that the commander's responsibility for the atrocities did not warrant a death sentence. It's not my job to pass judgment on whether he did or he didn't. All I wanted to do this week in the podcast that I, Terry Wenuncle, Tales and the Battlefields, is tell the story of not necessarily Mayer, although we will discuss him in detail, but of the 20 lads that died in the Abbey of Ardennes near Caen in June of 1944. On this podcast, we mainly talk about what happened in the Great War. But in May of this year, it's now just turned June, I guided two different tours over to the Normandy battlefields. And on both occasions, we visited the site of this massacre. I couldn't get it out of my head on the way home. So what I thought I would do is talk about what happened to those lads and hope that by telling their story in this podcast, that they will always be remembered, that they won't be forgotten for the horror that they went through in the last few moments of their young lives. So before we look in detail about what happened, let's just set the scene really. And to do this, I'm using James Holland's excellent book, which he called Normandy 44, D-Day and the Battle for France. And he tells us that Kurt Mayer's SS panzers could call on at least 50 artillery pieces and a similar number of tanks, as well as highly mobile infantry who were bristling with mortars and machine guns. As the British and Canadians came off of the beaches, they found themselves up against a completely different set of soldiers than they'd encountered on the beaches themselves. And in this area, near Caen, the Canadians were going to come up against this 12th SS Hitler Youth, a completely different calibre and level of equipment and firepower to the German infantry that they'd already met on D-Day. The men of this 12th Hitler Youth were without exception highly motivated, very disciplined, and they would do exactly as they were ordered to do by their senior officers. That's what Nazis did, wasn't it? 65% of them were 18 years old and only 3% of them were over 25 years old, and they were mainly the officers. And Caen, as we know, was supposed to be taken on D-Day, but it hadn't been. The Canadians were pushing forward alongside their British allies and the North Nova Scotia Highlanders were leading the advance. There was just one battalion supported by 50 Shermans of the Sherbrooke Fusiliers. Their advance was supposed to be supported by the Royal Canadian Artillery Field Regiment, as well as by some offshore naval guns, but they were engaged elsewhere. And the naval cruisers out at sea, they couldn't help because the naval forward observer, he couldn't communicate with them because there was too much radio traffic and there was interference. The Canadians also didn't have their usual allocation of anti-tank guns. They hadn't been unloaded. Stormy seas in the English Channel was largely to blame for that. The countryside around Caen was very different to the American battle area to the west. Here the landscape was more open. There was wide fields, very flat. And from his viewpoint in the towers of the Ardennes Abbey, Kurt Mayer could see all the way to the beaches of Juno, which were 8 miles away. In other words, he could see exactly what was going to happen in the forthcoming attack by the Canadians. And it was an ideal position. in which to sight his waiting tanks and artillery. The Nova Scotias, with their Sherbrooke Fusiliers in support, were advancing, trying to get to the airfield nearby, and by midday the Canadians had managed to push back the Germans and get through a couple of villages. And next on the road to the airfield was Orty. The airfield was now just 3 miles to the southwest. But from his position in the Ardennes Abbey, Kurt Mayo was getting his men ready for the planned counterattack, and that was due to be launched at 4 o'clock p.m. This was to be a major drive forward, with both two divisions of panzers operating side by side. And the idea was that they were going to, and I quote, drive the enemy who'd broken through into the sea and destroy him. The arrival of the Canadians in front of him rather upset Mayo's plans, because they forced him to engage far earlier than intended, and so without the kind of coordination that might have been achieved had he been able to stick to the 4 p.m. time that he planned for. The Canadian advance reached that small village of Altwy, and then, just as they probed forward once more, they came into contact with the 12th SS Hitler Youth. Tank jaws opened up, both sides lost armour, heavy shelling thundered into the village and in the fields nearby. Mayo's men were now advancing along the northwest of Caen. There was smoke and the fog of war obscured his view, Mayo that is. But he was pumped up with adrenaline. He jumped on a motorcycle and he sped forward, speeding past some 50 Canadian prisoners who were being frog-marched towards the abbey. No sooner had he reached the open ground, and Canadian Shermans opened fire and shells began whistling around him. Diving for cover in a shell hole, he was startled to find himself face to face with a Canadian soldier. They looked at each other warily. Then the Canadian made a dash for it as more shells flew over. Mayer eventually found one of his commanders. Mayer said himself that one could no longer identify the village. Smoke, explosions and flames marked its position. And by around 4 o'clock, the Canadians were pulling back as their artillery was finally arriving to give support. It was clear, however, that by now they were being pushed back and had taken heavy casualties. But this was far from being a rout. They'd taken considerable toll on the Germans too. And with their artillery now joining in, the situation for the Germans was worsening. Eventually, the Germans managed to overpower the Canadians. But in these two villages of Buron and Autry, the SS went on the rampage. One of their commanding officers was a man called Milius. He was an old-fashioned SS Nazi who'd previously worked at the Dachau concentration camp. It's said that wounded Canadians were bayoneted and bludgeoned to death, and a number of those trying to surrender were shot. 8 prisoners under guard were executed, and then 2 of the bodies were dragged onto the main road, and a Mark IV tank was brought up to run back and forth repeatedly over the corpses. Other Canadian captured men saw this happen. Afterwards, a French civilian was authorised to remove the mess. He needed a shovel to do so. And then things got even worse, if that's possible. A further 18 Canadian prisoners of war were shot in the grounds of that abbey that evening. And of the 110 Canadians who died that day, at least 37 were executed, while others were murdered by panzers deliberately guided to run over a number of wounded men lying by the side of the road. Witnesses recalled seeing the streets running with blood. These poor Canadians had come up against the dreaded SS, one of the best equipped and the most motivated divisions in the German armed forces at that time. They outnumbered and outgunned the Canadian force. But there'd been no drive to the sea. They hadn't beaten the Canadians. They hadn't stopped the invasion. The Canadians were excellently trained, ferocious fighters, as we've seen recently in the Great War, especially in places like Vimy Ridge. And don't think for a minute that the Allies didn't carry out atrocities too. One veteran, James Holland says in his book, was called Bob Slaughter, appropriately enough, and he'd been told expressly not to take any prisoners on D-Day. And what everybody must have known at the end of this day, D-Day plus one, that the battle for Normandy was going to be very, very brutal. Eventually, when the Canadians took the Ardennes Abbey, they didn't know about what had happened in the courtyard at the back because the bodies had been buried. There was no sign of the atrocities that had been carried out. But what they did find was Mayer's bedroom in the abbey itself. He'd left in such a hurry that he hadn't had time to drink his champagne or eat his cherries. But the Canadians did it for him. They drank his champagne, they ate his cherries, and an exhausted Canadian officer slept in his bed. So it was shortly after 9 o'clock on a sunny morning last week that we ventured into that courtyard. It was very quiet. There was only us there. The fields around us, the crops were blowing in the breeze. In the distance, we could see those villages where those poor Canadians had been run over. But let's now listen to what we found when we visited the Ardennes Abbey. This is a recording of our visit. And you'll also hear occasionally the words of the people that I was guiding. So in the days after D-Day, they had to try and move inland, just like we've done this morning, driving in from Oistram, getting off the beaches. We know they've got a bridgehead now, but they've got to take down these German positions in these villages. And of course, this is an ideal position, a defensive position for the Germans. And the Canadians, the Germans have got machine gun in those two windows at the top there. And also good for observation. The whole area, the whole abbey was good for observation. So the Canadians have come off of Juno Beach, and they're coming across this field here. And obviously those trees are not as high as what they are now. But if you've got a couple of MG 42s, the most powerful one of all, isn't it? You've got a wonderful field of fire. Those modern houses are not there. It's the, you know, a few days after D-Day, you've got a wonderful field of fire. But the Canadians have got to take this abbey. And time after time they come across here, but you can see that they're giving the Germans it back, you know, because they are mortar rounds on there, artillery shells that have hit that building. But this is centuries old, this abbey, and it's withstood it. But the Germans holding this are no ordinary Germans. This is the SS.
Is it?
The Waffen SS. 12th Panzer Division of the Hitler Youth, a particular nasty bunch. Kurt Mayer, commander of the 25th Panzer Grenadier Regiment within that 12th Division. 12th Panzer Division, this is his headquarters. And unfortunately, about 20 Canadians are captured and brought here for interrogation. Let's go and see what happened to them, shall we?
Oh dear.
So this is the 3rd Canadian Division we talked about, mentioned yesterday. They landed on Juno Beach on the 6th of June. And this board here tells us on the 6th of June, Operation Overlord, the Allied invasion of Normandy, began with the airborne and amphibious landing across the 50-mile front. And with the Canadian, the 3rd Canadian Infantry Division and the 2nd Canadian Armoured Brigade. But they managed to get a beachhead and bridgehead, and they advanced inland. And then, like we said just now, they come across places like this that are German defensive positions. And that next morning, commanders of the 25th Panzer Grenadier Regiment within the 12th Panzer Division watch from the rooftops of this abbey as the Canadian vanguard, the men at the front, approach. And after a day-long battle for the nearby villages, 11 Canadian prisoners were executed in the garden that we're about to go into. 7 more were interrogated here the next day. And after shaking hands with their comrades, each young man was either shot or bludgeoned to death. Some of the bodies were buried in the garden, and 2 more Canadians were killed nearby on or about the 17th of June. And it wasn't just here that Germans murdered prisoners of war. In round and about, there were others that were rounded up and either beaten and shot or bayoneted. And some of them, it says here on the board, in a village nearby, were deliberately crushed by German vehicles as they passed. This is the SS. So the Canadians, they finally captured this area. It took them a whole month, we can see there from the date. It wasn't until the 9th of July that they captured this abbey on the edge of Caen. The 1st Canadian, the 2nd British armies fought south towards Falaise, where we're going to go tomorrow. And among them, they discovered some of the young Canadians who died.
Now, the German commander here, this Kurt Mayer, this photographer got here, he was convicted for war crimes on this site, but he ended 8 years in Canada, and he ended up working for the United Nations, and he died of a heart attack. But this is the beautiful garden itself, surrounded by trees, and the ancient walls, sandstone walls of the abbey itself. On the trees within the courtyard, there are Canadian flags with poppies attached to them. And here we've got details of those young boys that died here on that day. And there's an information board giving us a timeline of what happened here in three different languages. There was a Madame Vico, she was arrested by the Gestapo, but in early August 1944, it says that she was freed. She was able to return to the abbey, which was in ruins. She came back with the two youngest children and a son, Jean-Marie, who was a resistance fighter. And his work was over after Kahn had fallen. Then in September, after the area had been secured, a Canadian Sergeant Dutka came back to the farm, told them how, taken prisoners with other soldiers, he managed to escape through a small door. But he said, I'd seen the bodies. Mm. And then in 1945, the war having moved on a long way east, the little park that we're standing in was spared the bombing. The two youngest children, Roland and Michelle, they noticed that the soil at the foot of the small chestnut tree had been turned over. They dug and they found the first body lying face downwards, a bullet hole in the nape of the neck, and it wore a military uniform. And later, Jean-Marie finds more bodies in the same position and places crosses on the sites. And then in March, Mademoiselle Vico notices that the snowdrops surrounding the lawn of the little park are growing in a disorderly manner, even though the rest of the lawn has regained its original aspect. Puzzled, she asks her sons to dig, and they find four more bodies. And then in May 1945, with the end of the war coming, her other son, Jacques, he comes home on leave from the army, wishing to pursue a more systematic method to aid in the discovery of the bodies. He asks a dowser, Father Gab, to search the whole grounds, and the last bodies are found. And the British authorities identify the bodies, which are then given the graves they deserve in the Canadian cemetery nearby at Beni St. Mer. And there were 20 of them. 12 belonged to the North Nova Scotia Highlanders, 6 to the Sherbrooke Fusiliers Regiment, within the Canadian Armoured Regiment, and 2 were from the Dundas, Stormont and Glengarry Highlanders with their Scottish heritage, as we said. And then in June 1945, with the war now over, an eyewitness, a young Pole, said he'd been recruited by force when he was 16. He recounted the story of the dramatic events. He relates the question he underwent and repeats all that he'd heard, and finally he reported the executions. Yeah. And all the bodies had revealed, is now clarified, the Canadian authorities conducted an inquiry amongst the German soldiers who could have known something about the incidents. Their accounts all match up with the Poles, and the file about General Kurt Mayer is sent to the authorities. In December 1945, Mayer, present at the Abbey when these murders took place, is accused. The Geneva Convention had clearly been violated. The first trial of war criminals takes place in Canada. Several charges are held against him. He's accused of torturing and murdering war prisoners, summary executions, concealed bodies who'd been buried without any respect, without any cross or any sign allowing them to be found. And Mademoiselle Vico and her son Jean-Marie are summoned as witnesses, as well as the Poles and others. Mayer is found guilty and he's actually sentenced to death, but the sentence is reduced to a prison sentence, which he serves in Canada. And in 1954, there's a tendency towards reconciliation, and Mayer is, what's that say?
Freed. For good.
He's freed for good conduct on the 7th of June 1954, and 7 years after that, he dies of a heart attack in 1961. So he manages to die of natural causes.
That small chestnut tree.
Which one is it?
That one there, that's the chest.
The flowering one, just behind us. And that's where the first body was found, wasn't it? Just at the foot of it. Yeah. Yeah, that small chestnut tree now with a Canadian flag wrapped around it. We're standing here now. It's where that first body was found.
We don't get the reconciliation thing. We just don't understand. But at the time, Russia became
the enemy.
That turned the Germans on our side.
On our side, and they still are to this day, of course. You know, they're one of our... And even before both wars, they were probably one of our greatest allies in the fight against the common enemy, which was the French. And there's quite a modern memorial here listing the names of those boys that died. Gives us a summary of what we've just been talking about. Lists all their names. And then on the wall of the abbey is a photograph of all of those lads that died here. And we look at them. So many of them have got Scottish heritage, haven't they? You can tell by their hats. James Bolt, Walter Doherty, George Gill, Roger Lockhead, Hugh MacDonald, George Pollard, Harold Phillip, and on it goes. And there's more information here about the battle for the abbey. There's an information board put here by the local tourist board. In June 1944, it says the battle was raging between soldiers of the 12th SS and the Canadian troops around the abbey and the neighbouring villages. And the Canadian mission was to control the nearby aviation field at Carpique on the west side of Caen. It's an airfield that's still there. And on the 7th, the Germans launched a counterattack, and there was an intense tank battle lasting 2 hours. Heavy losses occurred. The infantry put up a good defence, the Canadians. They lost 37 soldiers, and then the others were taken prisoner. Their losses, 11 dead, 30 injured, and 204 missing, including 18 prisoners. These boys were brought here to the commanding HQ of that man, Kurt Mayer. Possible to think now as we listen to the bird song, we look at the trees and this beautiful little garden of the horrors that took place here shortly after D-Day 1944. And those boys, Reginald Keeping, Thomas Henry, Charles Doucet, Ivan Crow, Hollis McNeil, Faye McIntyre, George Miller, Raymond Moore, James Moss, Freddie Williams, and Thomas Windsor. They were all either shot in the back of the head or bludgeoned to death. Where we now stand, looking at the chestnut tree that witnessed the horrors that took place here on that June day, 82 years ago. The chestnut tree that's now blossoming.
So, who were the 20 boys from Canada that are remembered in that garden that they died in? As I said, the photographs are on the wall. And what I'd like to do now is just read out their names with a little bit of information about them. The first one was Private James Bolt of the Sherbrooke Fusiliers. He was 32 years old when he died. He had blonde hair with blue eyes and was very small. He had several health concerns. Came to England on September the 2nd, 1943, and he was a radio operator. He's buried in the Canadian cemetery at Benny-sur-Mer. Private Charles Doucet was with the North Nova Scotia Highlanders, buried in the same cemetery at Benny. He came from Sydney in Nova Scotia. He was 31 years old. He joined up in 1940. His family often came to the Ardennes Abbey to remember him. He had four daughters. Private George Gill was with the Sherbrooke Fusiliers, buried at Benny. He was 23 years old and he was a native of the United Kingdom. His mother died when he was just a year old and his father emigrated to Canada, where George followed. He loved baseball, and he worked in a tile factory until October of 1942, and that's when he was enrolled in the tank regiment. He lied about his age that he gave to the recruiter. He said he was born in 1921, but he wasn't. He was born in 1922. Private Thomas Henry, with the Sherbrooke Fusiliers, buried at Benny. He was 22 years old. He came from Montreal. He'd been studying at university, where he was in the second year of chemical engineering. He joined up in June of 1942 and gave up his studies. and Private Reginald Keeping of the North Nova Scotia Highlanders, buried at Benny, of course. 21 when he died, he was from a town called Burgio in Newfoundland, and he was a telegram operator at a very early age, and he also ran a bowling alley, and he was part of the local baseball and hockey teams, and he enlisted in March of 1943. His service record shows he was a bit of a rebel. He was absent without permission, and it's said that his parents continually had problems during their grieving process. His father, Wilson, never really got over it. He kept saying, "Why, Reg?" And he died. His mother had lost her only son and also her husband. Private James Moss, also serving with the North Nova Scotia Highlanders, 22 years old, from a town called Stellarton. He wasn't shot. He was one of those that was beaten to death. He was the first from his town to join the Canadian Army, and he was the first to be captured at dawn on June the 7th. He was one of those whose body was found beneath the chestnut tree. An officer, Lieutenant Fred Williams, was serving with the Stormont Dundas and Glengarry Highlanders. He was wounded at the age of 22. He'd enlisted in 1944. He became an officer in 1942. He was a small man and a quiet character, but he inspired confidence in his men. A Private Ivan Crowe, the North Nova Scotia Highlanders. He's the first that we're going to talk about that's not buried at Benny. He's buried in another Canadian cemetery not far away at Brettville. He was another one that was 22. He came from New Glasgow in Nova Scotia. During his final leave before D-Day in July 1943, he overstayed his leave. He was away for 7 days instead of four. He lost several days' pay, probably because he met a young English woman called Dorothy Rowe. They'd fallen in love. She was the reason why he was late back from leave. And Private Walter Doherty, another 22-year-old from New Brunswick, he got caught up in that German counterattack. He was cut off from the rest of his company. He was captured and murdered. Private Roger Lockhead with the Sherbrooke Fusiliers, 25 years old, came from Montreal. He'd got married on June the 1st, 1941, to Rose. I look up now at the calendar. It's June the 1st, 2026, as a coincidence. He was the father of a young boy called Richard, and he wrote 4 or 5 letters per week to his family. And the plan was that after the war, he was to become a farmer. Private Hugh MacDonald of the North Nova Scotia Highlanders was 24, from Morvan in Nova Scotia. He left school early because his father had died, and he worked on a farm and in a sawmill. And in February 1942, he joined the infantry. And he's the only one that we don't have a photograph of. Instead of a photograph, there's a pencil drawing that was published in the local newspaper where he came from. And Corporal Joseph McIntyre, also of the North Nova Scotia Highlanders, he was 28. He came from Sydney Mines. He was another that had got himself into a bit of bother. In June of 1941, he found himself in prison for 10 days for disobeying a direct order. But according to one of his comrades, he was a natural leader who inspired his men and was well respected. Before he left for Europe, he asked his brother and his wife to call their child after him. It was a girl. She was called Marie Frances. His brother never told his mother the exact truth about his death when it became known. Because of her old age, they wanted to save her from the painful circumstances. She just thought he'd been killed in action. Private George Miller, the North Nova Scotia Highlanders, he was just 19, from Ontario. He was a baker's son. He was very popular with his classmates because he kept bringing bags of buns to school, and he left school at 14 to become a delivery boy with his father. He wanted to enlist in 1940, but he was too young. And it was only in 1942 that he enlisted. And even at that stage, he was still too young. And Private Thomas Mont, all we know about him, serving with the North Nova Scotia Highlanders, that he was 23 years old. He came from Truro in Nova Scotia and was married to a lady called Joan. And Private Raymond Moore, same battalion, 27 years old, came from Kentville. That's all we know about him. Soldier George McNaughton, North Nova Scotia Highlanders, came from Sydney and was 20 when he died. Being an illegitimate child, he lived in an orphanage with his brother, who became separated from him. He held various occupations. He was a labourer in a brick factory and then in a sawmill. He was then a dishwasher in a self-service restaurant and a docker. He was one of those that was surrounded by the Germans and taken prisoner, as was Private Harold Philip Sherbrooke Fusiliers, 32 years old, from Manila in Ontario. He was the youngest of a family of five children, and he had to leave school to work on his parents' farm just to make ends meet. On his recruitment papers, it says he was intelligent and well-built. Corporal George Pollard was with the Stormont Dundas and Glengarry Highlanders, just 19, from Cornwall in Ontario. Another one that lied about his age, and he begged his mother not to denounce him. In a letter to his family in late 1943, he says, "I have the impression that the war will be over in the spring and I'll be at home." So from that we can deduce he was worried about it being over before he got there. In the margin, he drew caricature drawings of members of his family that he was looking forward to seeing. His mother was called Ethel, and she lived to be 90 years old. She lived in that same house where George was born. She wouldn't move. She said she was waiting for a son to reappear at the kitchen door. And Lieutenant Thomas Windsor, with the Sherbrooke Fusiliers, also buried in Brettville. So about half of these are in Brettville, and the other half are in Benny. He was born in 1914 from Montreal. And before the war, he was employed as a buyer. And it's said that he was a force of nature and he loved playing bridge. He was also a good sportsman. He was captain of his polo team. And once engaged in the armoured unit, he rose up the ranks. We know that he was taken prisoner with the crew of his tank. He refused to answer questions from the SS. All he would give was his name, rank and serial number. He was the commanding officer of the other men that we've talked about from the Sherbrooke Fusiliers. An SS officer led him into the garden with the crew of his tank, and these eight men shook hands one last time and then were killed one by one upon the call of their name. And Private Hollis McKeel is the only one that's buried in the Royers Commonwealth War Graves Commission Cemetery. He was 33 years old. He'd been shot in the chest and was confined to a stretcher during that day, June the 7th. By nightfall, he was alone with an ankle injury. He found refuge in a building that turned out to be occupied by the SS. And that led him to the Ardennes Abbey. So what happened? The trial of Mayer. These murders occurred within 150 metres of his command post. He was there when these killings were happening. A witness at the trial said that he heard Mayer order his young soldiers to take no more prisoners during the battle. And the evidence indicated that even if he had not directly ordered the murders, he'd surely known about them and he did nothing to stop them. He, of course, claimed that he knew nothing about it and denied that he'd ordered the Canadians to be shot. But he was found guilty 2 days after Christmas 1945, sentenced to death, but then, as we know, he was commuted to life imprisonment just a few days later. And within months, he'd been taken to Canada. And that should have been the end of the story then. That should have been where he lived out his days. But that wasn't to be the case. After his conviction, naturally the people in Canada were furious that he'd been spared the death sentence. Some of the newspapers argued that his sentence was a betrayal of Canada's war dead. One letter in the Toronto Telegram said that our boys were innocent. This man should be made to suffer in the same way he made them suffer. And another letter to the Winnipeg Free Press said, one can now visualise Mayer's supercilious grin, but there are no smiles on the faces of the families in Canada bereft of their loved ones. One newspaper claimed that Canada had lost its only chance to show to the German people the strength and powers of Canadian law and provide a warning to all those who would dare harm Canadian prisoners of war in the future. But as always, there is another side to the story. There was a few who spoke out in support of Mayer being spared. Three army officers, they wrote to a newspaper called the Maple Leaf, which was the paper of the Canadian Army. They said, are we such little angels with respect to the charges that this man was condemned to death? And the Windsor Star argued that his sentence was commuted because it was realised that Canada's generals were likely guilty of the same crimes as Mayer. They said, there but for the grace of God go I. So Mayer was then really forgotten about for a few years. He got a job in the prison library. But in February of 1950, his story made the press again, as some people started to argue for his release and even suggested that he was innocent of the crimes that he'd been convicted of. But then there was another twist in the story, because by 1951, he was the only Nazi war criminal imprisoned outside of Germany, and the Germans wanted him to be released or transferred to one of their own prisons. And so on the 19th of October 1951, Mayer was transferred to a military prison at Wöhl in Germany. And under German law, he was allowed leave to go home. And incredibly, a journalist found him at home and interviewed him. He's reported as saying that nationalism is dead. He said, I would only become a soldier again as a member of a European army, not as a member of a German army alone. And that report became front page news back home in Canada. The world was changing in the early 1950s. And in mid-1952, May appeared on a list of war criminals that the German government wanted released. And in September of 1953, a board suggested that Mayer's sentence should be reduced, and their request was approved by the Canadian cabinet in January. And Mayer gained his freedom on the 7th of September 1954, a decade after his capture by the Allies. It's said that one of the reasons why he was released by the Canadians was because of politics. It was said that Canada was not willing to strain its relationship with West Germany just to keep Mayer in prison for a few more years. And as usual, there was divided opinion in Canada. On the 7th of September, the Sudbury Star wrote, had the horror of the murdered men's blood become so unrealistic that Canadian officials should decide to reduce the life sentence? Many veterans declared their anger that the government had so easily forgiven the murder of Canadian soldiers just because Mayer might serve a useful purpose in the new Germany. Although 9 years had passed since the end of the war, the memory of Canada's murdered soldiers remained as strong as ever. And some newspapers went even further. The Winnipeg Free Press said that the release of Mayer and other criminals meant that Germany will once again be able to exercise their special talents, the mass murder of men, women and children. But don't forget, as we said earlier, this was during the realities of the Cold War and the world was very scared of Russia. I suppose we still are to this day. A man called B.S. MacDonald wrote a book about Mayer's trial, and he said that if Mayer could serve a useful purpose in the West German army, that might result in the saving of lives of the Canadian youth in another conflict, then his release will be justified. He argued that Mayer's release would serve an important purpose in international politics. But I delved, as I like to do, into the newspaper archives. And I found here a short article that tells us what happened when he was released from prison in 1954. The newspaper tells us that thousands of former Nazi SS soldiers jammed the road yelling, "Hurrah!" to welcome ex-General Kurt Mayer home after his release from the British War Criminals Jail at Wöhl. They came in buses and cars, by bicycle and by train, to this small village near the Dutch border to give the former SS General of the Hitler Youth Division a hero's reception. Mayer, once sentenced to death for killing prisoners of war, was moved as he clasped in his arms his flaxen-haired 11-year-old son, Kurt, youngest of his five children. It was the first time that Panzer Mayer had seen the boy. His four daughters and his wife, all with tears in their eyes, hugged Mayer. Now, Mayer was undoubtedly a brave soldier. His father had fought during the Great War, therefore the military was in his blood. After the battles of June, he found himself caught up in the area known as the Falaise Pocket. His unit was facing certain defeat, but he managed to get them through the closing gap. And on the 6th of September, he was severely wounded and was later captured by Belgian partisans who turned him over to the British. After he'd been released from prison, he suffered from his war wounds. He had bad kidneys, suffered strokes, his heart was beginning to fail, and his time in prison had taken a great toll on him. And it was on his 51st birthday, on the 23rd of September 1961, that it all caught up with him. He had a heart attack and died. But he lived 17 years longer than those men that were murdered in the Ardennes Abbey near Caen. He was buried in his hometown of Hagen, and it's said that at his funeral, 15,000 people turned up to mourn him. Of course, we won't be mourning him. We've told his story in the same way that we've told the story of his alleged victims, the victims that he was convicted of killing. We will remember them instead by the playing of the Canadian National Anthem.
Strong and free from cold.